This is Michael J. Fox. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation's work and how you can help speed a cure at michaeljfox.org.
Welcome to a recap of our latest Third Thursday webinar. Hear directly from expert panelists as they discuss Parkinson's research and answer your questions about living with the disease. Join us live next time by registering for an upcoming webinar at michaeljfox.org.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Karen Jaffe, a member of the Michael J. Fox Foundation Patient Council. I'm also a founder of In Motion, an amazing wellness center for people with Parkinson's disease, located in Cleveland, and your moderator for today's very timely webinar. While we won't have time to discuss how world events are causing many of us to have mood changes, today we will be discussing how and why mood changes such as depression and anxiety happen in Parkinson's, how you and your loved ones can talk about these symptoms with each other and with your providers, and what treatment options are available. We do have a lot to discuss, so let's get started. First, let me introduce our panelists. Sebastian Crisp is an 18-time Grammy Award winner and CEO of Rebellion Entertainment. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2019. So thanks for joining us, Sebastian.
It's good to be here.
Roseanne Dobkin is an associate professor of psychiatry at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School at Rutgers University. Welcome, Dr. Dobkin.
Hello, I'm very happy to be here as well.
And Irene Richard is a professor of neurology and psychiatry at University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. Hi, Dr. Richard.
Hello, I'm happy to be here as well.
So when a person experiences mood changes such as anxiety and depression, a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease would not be the first thing to come to mind. Yet for many, it is the mood changes that are the first signs of Parkinson's disease, sometimes beginning years before the classic motor symptoms such as tremor and rigidity. So Sebastian, would you mind kicking off this conversation by sharing your story and what you were dealing with up to the point of getting diagnosed?
I was diagnosed in March of last year, and I had been experiencing depression and anxiety probably since about 4 or 5 years ago. And one of the things that didn't make sense to me is I was working on really what was kind of my dream project in 2018, and was just, you know, depressed, anxious, moody, and things didn't add up for me. It made no sense that I would be feeling that way while really realizing, you know, this wonderful project that I was working in. And, I have a Gaucher's disease, so I knew that Parkinson's was a possibility, and I started just looking into it. Just because I saw that, you know, when I read up about it, I saw that depression and anxiety were part of the symptoms.
So you think you had it for 4 or 5 years before you got diagnosed with Parkinson's disease?
I for the depression and anxiety for sure. And again, it didn't. You know, I have a wife, two kids. My job is basically what my hobby was when I was a kid. I don't. On paper, there's no reason for me to be depressed or anxious about anything. So that's. You know, that was a big red flag for me.
Dr. Dobkin, what percentage of people with Parkinson's develop anxiety and or depression? And does the incidence increase with the length of diagnosis?
Those are really great questions. So statistics that you read will vary based on the type of study that was done and the setting in which it was conducted. But I would say it's completely accurate and probably a conservative estimate to say that the majority, 50% or greater, of people with Parkinson's will experience symptoms of depression or anxiety that impact their day-to-day. And then another percentage of individuals will experience maybe milder symptoms of depression and anxiety that maybe aren't there, you know, most of the time, but nonetheless will rear their ugly head from time to time and make life harder than it needs to be. With respect to depression and anxiety increasing over the course of the illness, I think the interesting thing to consider here is that depression and anxiety can impact people with Parkinson's really at any point. So we do see very high levels from pre-diagnosis, as we just heard, to early, mid, and late stage disease. And it is really dependent on really a mix of, you know, biological factors that are implicated in the onset and maintenance of depression and anxiety, as well as an individual's coping response to the various challenges that they're facing day in and day out.
Well, how often do they present together, depression and anxiety?
They are highly comorbid, which is the fancy term for saying they present together at very high rates. So again, I would like to say, just from my own clinical experience, as well as from, you know, reviewing latest research studies, they are probably there together at least half of the time.
Dr. Richard, we had a listener who's just asked if apathy is a part of this picture.
So, I mean, that's a good question, because apathy, apathy meaning, I guess, really, some people equate it with a lack of motivation, but really just not caring, and kind of being, you know, blah. But apathy can either occur in the setting, in the context of depression, as one of the symptoms, but it's also can occur as its own entity. So apathy in and of itself can occur in Parkinson's disease outside of the context of depression or anxiety. It's tricky. Apathy, when people just don't seem to have motivation to do things, the patients themselves tend not to complain of it, because by definition, they're apathetic. They really, you know, they don't really care. There's not a really, but it's usually, to be honest with you, it's the care partner who, you know, he or she just doesn't really want to do anything, doesn't seem to get over the hump, and I just want to get them to do something. I think they'd feel better if they did. So, you know, in those cases, we try to delve a little bit deeper, and we try to find out, is there actually a negative mood? In other words, when I say valence, kind of just direction. So, for example, when I ask the patient to themselves, you know, do you feel bad? In other words, do you feel like emotionally either down or distant or, you know, something negative? That's actually one of the key distinctions, I think, as opposed to, no, I'm fine. I just don't really feel like doing anything. And there are ways to approach both. But what I would say is that it's because we do not have a specific treatment for apathy. I mean, there are certain behavioral modifications and some things being studied, whereas, as we'll get to later, we do have specific treatments for depression. I think when apathy comes up, it's important to do a full screening for depression just to make sure that that's not what you're dealing with, since that is something you could treat.
So let's look at, you know, just like Parkinson's symptoms, mood symptoms show up in different ways for different people. Dr. Dopkin, we can see that there's some crossover. Depression and anxiety can look alike. Let me ask you, as a clinician whose practice focuses on the mental health of people with Parkinson's disease, can you please elaborate on what it is about Parkinson's disease that brings on depression or anxiety above and beyond what we see with other serious conditions?
That's a great question. And there are multiple factors that are involved in both sort of the onset and maintenance of depression and anxiety in Parkinson's. You know, first and foremost, we know that there are a lot of biological and neurochemical changes that result from the disease process that characterizes Parkinson's. So we see changes in sort of the amount and the availability of the feel-good chemicals called neurotransmitters that are, you know, available in the brain. We also see changes or traffic jams or interruptions across some of the highways that connect different areas of the brain, as well as, you know, some decreased activity in certain brain regions that are related to mood. But in addition to those biological and neurochemical changes, there are also behavioral factors and cognitive factors that are implicated in mood. So what do I mean by that? So when I say behavioral factors, you know, what a person is doing or not doing in response to the various and very real challenges that they're experiencing, you know, day in and day out. You know, does an individual have kind of enough exposure to the people, places, and things that provide them with a sense of satisfaction or reward or meaning or productivity in their day-to-day. You know, Parkinson's can really change the landscape of the day, and we really have to think creatively, you know, think outside of the box, sometimes build a better box to figure out, you know, how we really can expose ourselves to those life experiences that are going to enable us to feel good about ourselves. You know, so is an individual exercising? Are they engaged in, you know, meaningful social connections? Do they have hobbies or leisure activities that enable them to feel good about themselves? So we really need to look kind of behaviorally at what an individual is doing, as well as consider, you know, how they're thinking about themselves and their world and their future, you know, what Parkinson's may mean or not mean for them and their ability to, you know, to cope with the changes and difficulties that they are going to be experiencing from time to time. So really, depression and anxiety are multifactorial. The biology sets the stage, but how an individual reacts and copes with the changes and the challenges that Parkinson's presents also plays a really important role. So, you know, learning coping skills to best manage stress and negative feelings, as well as becoming aware of, you know, how we're talking to ourselves. What are the messages that we are giving to ourselves? You know, are we speaking to ourselves with the same kind, gentle, you know, compassionate tone that we would speak to a dear friend, or are we being overly critical and harsh towards ourselves? And oftentimes those self-critical messages play a very important role in maintaining these negative mood states.
So Sebastian, if you look at this laundry list, what were some of the things that you were experiencing, and has this list changed over time for you?
I mean, the sleep problems are definitely an issue. Irritability, you know, I worry all the time, just mood swings, and just feeling really down. I for me, it really helps to exercise. You know, I don't take a day off. I exercise 7 days a week, and like this morning, you know, I did not want to, and I just forced myself to do it. I look at it as part of my treatment. You know, just like the medicine I have to take every day, that's part of the medicine.
Were you an exerciser before you had Parkinson's?
I was, but you know, it had a different meaning to me. Now I just look at it as medicine. I have to be regimented about it. I don't give myself the option. So that's a big part of it. I think one of the things is for me is to be able to, you know, and I'm also taking medicine for the depression, and you know, I go to therapy, so I really feel like I have to attack this from all sides, and to really, you know, talk about it with my family and for people to understand that this, you know, that this is a real aspect of it, and to be honest with you, when I got diagnosed, it was kind of a relief to understand that, okay, my depression is coming from this disease and not something else. You know, to have that question answered was really a weight off of my shoulders, and I was able to look at it in a different way.
That's an important thing to remember as we go through this and talk about this, because a lot of people, you know, for some people, talking about what's going on is easier said than done. And it's also, but as hard as it is to do it, it's so important that we do talk about mood changes that we're experiencing, because this is not about pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. And depression and anxiety are medical conditions, just like diabetes or heart disease. But unlike diabetes and heart disease, the stigma that still hangs over a mental health diagnosis does have the ability to keep some people from asking for help. Dr. Richard, do you find that most Parkinson's clients will address these issues of depression and anxiety directly with you, or is it more likely that a care partner will be the one to initiate the conversation?
I mean, everything you just said is all very important and very relevant. So if I will, first just to kind of agree with you that I think it's so important for people to understand that depression, regardless of whether you have Parkinson's disease or not, you know, depression is an illness just as any other illness is. And I think that, you know, just as diabetes is, just as, and in this case, depression is an actual symptom of Parkinson's disease that can occur years before, that can occur, you know, at the onset, that can occur during, and, you know, just like tremor, just like anything else. So, and I think that there is a misconception about that actually really among there's a widely held misconception about depression that in some way, you know, it's the same as sadness or that someone actually has the ability to, like you just said, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And sometimes if I ask people, you know, well, if I start the inquiry and say, are you depressed? Oh no, I'm a very positive thinker. You know what I mean? I just, you know, in other words, as if there can, which is a good thing to be a positive thinker, mind you, as Dr. Dobkin will talk, there's a way, you know, that is an important factor. But whereas the converse of that is that if somebody does have depression, they feel as though somehow, you know, they're letting it get to them and they're not taking a positive enough attitude and somehow they caused this. And I think it's just so important to understand that while you can work on changing your, you know, the ways in which we, you know, like cognitive therapy, behavioral therapy, the ways in which you think about things, it's really important first to just understand that I have patients who are far more affected physically and far more disabled who are not depressed than patients who have almost no symptoms or, you know, in some cases haven't even developed physical symptoms yet and have depression. So it is definitely something of that people do not, it is not a reflection of one's, certainly not one's moral character, but nor one's desire to, you know, combat something or not. So that was the first thing, and just because I think that's so important. And I do think there still is a stigma. And I think fortunately, although it's like many other things in our society, is slow to change in the positive direction, I think it is. What I would say is that it really depends upon the individual and their partner. I think sometimes the individual will bring it up. Sometimes the partner will. Sometimes neither will. Very often, particularly when the clinician in a neurology practice anyway, and I guess we should specify that Dr. Dobkin is a psychologist and I'm a neurologist, which, you know, we both do research, just slightly different in the sense that, you know, maybe what the focus of what we do is. And I don't know about the time given. I know that certain, in our case, you know, we're being asked to do more and more in less and less time. And so, you know, yeah, people sometimes will skip over that. And I think that I would say that in general, depression is under-recognized, and because of that, it's under-treated. And I think that it is important, as you say, for the patients and their loved ones to bring it up if their clinician does not bring it up. And just as when I talk to clinicians, I say it's a very important part of a screening question to ask about are there symptoms of depression or anxiety, because they can be treated and because they can impact, they have a huge impact on everything else. So, yeah, again, it really varies, but the more we can educate people, and the more that we can get people to kind of try to forget that stigma, try to understand that it's an actual symptom, and then to try to feel free to talk about it, the more we can do that, the better.
Yeah, and it's too bad that Parkinson's itself has a stigma, so we've got a double whammy here. Sebastian, I'm curious how your relationship with your spouse and your children, do they kind of sort of, when you're having a bad day, do they just say, oh, this is Parkinson's, or they say, oh, you know, do you mind them bringing it up, or do you mind them having to talk, asking you to talk about it at all, or what, how you're feeling, or would you rather, meaning would you rather be left to your own devices to try to fix it, or is it helpful to have your care partner and your family participate in this part of your Parkinson's disease?
I kind of let my spouse know, you know, I'm feeling down today. Just to let them understand that, you know, there's not anything particular that they have to, you know, worry about or be concerned about. Just know that, you know, I'm having an off day. It just helps me to not be able, you know, not have to have them feel like, you know, they need to treat me any differently or whatnot.
Right.
You know, it's more just like, hey, you know, today's an off day, you know, no particular reason.
Right.
You know, I also found that there are things that trigger the depression that are very trivial. And I kind of walk it back and try to figure out why I'm having a bad day. If it was something specific that triggered it, and you know, it can be like the smallest thing can just, you know, make me just go down a rabbit hole. And once I'm able to trace it back, it helps me just sort of get out of it. You know, I do talk to, you know, talk to them about it. And I do talk to, you know, even my clients about it. You know, I work in music. So what the mood is while you're making music is important. You know, and I bring it up. I mean, it's just part of it. I think that bringing it up helps everybody understand everything differently. You know, even if it's a little bit uncomfortable for people in the beginning, I think for me, I can't speak for anybody else, but for me, it just helps me have things, you know, out in the open.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Dobkin, we have a question coming from the audience. They want to know, as a husband and caretaker, how should we help with mood swings? And how would you suggest that the care partner participate in this whole issue of anxiety, depression, mood disorders?
I feel like this might be, and I apologize for changing the order, but I think I wanted to mention something that I think might set the stage and also is an important distinction, prior to Dr. Dobkin answering that question, just to say that when we talk about swings, so, you know, there's depressive disorders and anxiety disorders, meaning you can have, you know, depression that is present, you know, maybe every day for a period of time. It might be mild. It might be more severe. And you may have some days that are better than others or some parts of some days that are better than others. Same thing with anxiety. But in those cases, we consider it more of a disorder. I think the one important thing I just want to point out is that there's another phenomena that is unique to people who have slightly more advanced disease and who are taking medications. Generally, they're taking carbidopa, levodopa, or Sinemet, and they have what we refer to as fluctuations. We usually think of those as motor fluctuations, meaning in the beginning, their levodopa works nice and evenly and kind of mimics how our brain would normally release it. So things are nice and steady with regard to our motor functioning anyway. Over time, however, because there are fewer dopamine neurons and because of changes that happen, you start to get swings in the levels of dopamine, and people's motor function, therefore, starts to dramatically change throughout the day. And it may start off as just, let's say you wear off, meaning your symptoms of Parkinson's disease, slowness, tremor, or whatever, start to reemerge before you're ready for your next dose. The other component of that is that in the beginning, you may not get, you know, the amount of Sinemet that you take works just right. You feel fine. But over time, you become more susceptible to getting extra movements, and we call those dyskinesias. Over time, these can be so dramatic that patients can be rendered immobile, literally, within 5 minutes to looking normal or to looking normal but having extra movements. What's important to realize is that there are also non-motor fluctuations, which not always, but often parallel the motor fluctuations, but are not a response to them. So, for example, anxiety and decreased mood are very common when people's medicine is wearing off, so during off periods. And studies have been done that show it's not just that you are anxious or depressed because your symptoms reemerged, because the symptoms of anxiety and depression actually start about 5 to 10 minutes before the motor symptoms do. So in this case, it really is mood swings, but in particular, we refer to them as fluctuations. And the reason why that's important is if that's what's going on, you first want to, first of all, identify it as such, and you want to first try to level out the dopamine and fix those motor fluctuations to see if that will also fix the mood and anxiety fluctuations. And both can exist. So I just thought that that was important because I know, you know, there are certainly swings and good days and bad days and provocations, even within a more chronic kind of anxiety and depressive disorder. But Parkinson's disease is probably the only disease in which there is this other unique phenomena called motor and mood fluctuations associated with advancing disease and medications.
So I would like to just kind of sort of jump in there and say probably the best way to manage this is to just have a discussion with the neurologist. When is it happening? In what context is it happening?
And that's exactly what happens. So, you know, I am a neurologist, and when my patient tells me, you know, when oftentimes a resident will see the patient first and, you know, they'll say, well, you know, they're anxious and, you know, I'll say to them, well, what time of the day does that happen? And how does that happen in relation to the timing of their Sinemet dosage? And I have them map it out in a diary. And sometimes it's as simple as changing their dopamine, their medication regimen, and we can smooth that out, or we can at least get rid of that component and then see if there is still an underlying more chronic anxiety or depressive disorder.
So Dr. Dobkin, I'm going to hang that one up for right now. I'd like to move into this next slide because there's a lot on here that I want us all to talk about. This slide outlines the many therapeutic interventions, both pharmacologic as well as non-pharmacologic. So Dr. Richard, I'm getting a lot of questions in the queue regarding medications. So let me start with you. What are the best medications for anxiety, depression with Parkinson's disease, and which antidepressants ease depression without worsening movement symptoms?
Right. Great question. And so this is basically the one thing about, so although depression and anxiety are frequently, you know, coexistent, depression and the treatment for depression has been better studied. Anxiety is about maybe 10 years behind. What I will say about depression is that we know, based on this SAD-PD study is one of them that, you know, was done a number of years ago, published in 2012, which showed that frequently used antidepressants, the serotonergic specific ones, so we call them SSRIs, as well as ones that we call that are affect both serotonin and norepinephrine, so SNRIs, what we looked at was we happened to pick Paxil or paroxetine as our SSRI and Effexor or venlafaxine as the SNRI. And it was proven that each of those medications was more effective than placebo on every single measure of depressions, self-rated, objective-rated, every single measure. So it was actually a pretty clear-cut study, and that was despite a very high placebo response. That's kind of a technicality. But suffice it to say, SSRIs, so again, medications like in this case, the only one we can say for sure is paroxetine because, and there may be some conflicting results, but just because that was chosen. But in all likelihood, I think one could surmise that other medications of that class might also be effective, and it's reasonable to look at the side effect profile. So other medications would include, for example, you know, sertraline, which is Zoloft, or fluoxetine, which is Prozac, Celexa, although one must be careful in people over the age of 60 with regard to the high, any higher dosage because of some potential cardiac effects. But anyway, all of those. So what's used in the general population who doesn't have Parkinson's disease. And then the SNRIs, I would say the one to use would be venlafaxine or Effexor. And what I would say is that in general, most people will start with one or the other. So I tend to start myself with, I would tend to start with an SSRI like Paxil. And then if, despite optimizing the dosage of that, it doesn't work, I will then move to an SNRI, which would be venlafaxine or Effexor. Now, there are older medications, they're called the tricyclic antidepressants, such as nortriptyline, which is definitely effective, but because it's associated with less tolerability, a little bit more in the way of side effects, as well as a higher potential to cause some heart arrhythmias, that's generally not first or second line treatment. The other possibility would be something like bupropion or Wellbutrin. Having said that, it has not been specifically studied for depression and Parkinson's disease, so we don't really know about it. Having said that, we do try it. As the last thing I'd say would be pramipexole, which actually is a medication called a dopamine agonist, which is part of the cache or arsenal, I guess if you want to call it, part of the choices of medications used to treat motor symptoms. Now, it just so happens that that does have some antidepressant effect, probably not as much, but if you have somebody and you want to try to get a 2-for-1, let's say, or let's say they are somebody who has these fluctuations, you could consider pramipexole or Mirapex, again, being aware that there are specific side effects associated with that. Anxiety, on the other hand, while you will often hear that the SSRIs and SNRIs are effective for anxiety as well, that's true in the non-Parkinson's population. Again, not for everybody, by the way, but, you know, 2/3 of people generally respond. There are about 1/3 of people who may not respond to the first or second trial. But as it turns out, nobody has studied that. And it just so happens that in that SAD-PD study I referred to, while all of the depression measures improved, the anxiety measures did not. Now, I must preface this by saying that those were individuals who did not have significant anxiety. So, for example, they were chosen because they had depression without a separate anxiety disorder. So, but nonetheless, they didn't improve. So we recently looked at a medication that is widely prescribed by psychiatrists and primary care doctors in the general population called Buspirone or Buspar, which is an anti-anxiety medication. We did a small pilot study that was funded by the Michael J. Fox Foundation because we thought, you know, this has the potential to help anxiety, possibly even help dyskinesias, but could worsen motor function. And we have not yet published it, although we had our abstract accepted. And what I would say about that was very interesting, that it turns out that it was not as well tolerated as we had hoped. And that it, in fact, did cause some worsening of motor function at relatively low dosages for more people than we would have expected, which was totally reversible as soon as they stopped it. But other people were able to tolerate it. And interestingly, the people who finished the study on it, there was a signal showing that it did help the anxiety. The other caveat to this is that I thought it was very interesting that 85% of the people who enrolled in our study were already on one of those SSRIs or SNRIs, which has two implications. One of them is maybe Buspirone would have been better tolerated if they weren't on that. But the other implication I thought was, wow, here's all these people who are on the medications that everybody thinks helps anxiety and Parkinson's, and yet they're still qualifying for our anxiety study. So I don't think we know what's a good medication to treat anxiety and Parkinson's disease yet. Commonly prescribed are medications called benzodiazepines. Those are things like Xanax and Valium and everything. And for sure, they do help anxiety, but they have their own issues. Obviously, particularly as people get older, but, you know, you can develop a tolerance to them where you have to increase dosages. They can affect balance. They can affect, you know, thinking. So while good in the short term, or perhaps, you know, for other reasons, they're not really the best answer. Having said all of that, do I still try an SSRI or an SNRI? Yes, I do, actually. And I start low because sometimes anxiety gets worse before it gets better. And I sometimes add a small benzodiazepine dose while I'm starting it. But by this point, I've usually referred somebody to a psychiatrist.
Enjoying this podcast, share it with a friend or rate and review it on iTunes. It helps listeners like you find and support our mission. MichaelJFox.org. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the podcast.
So, Dr. Dopkin, I'm going to turn to you now. We've got a whole long list there of under prescription medication of things that patients can try to improve their mood dysfunction. What do you find works well?
I think that it's really important to emphasize that in addition to all of the prescription medications that Dr. Richard so nicely just reviewed, there are a lot of non-medication approaches that people can also use, either in self-help format or ideally in collaboration with a licensed clinical psychologist or social worker to help them to boost their mood. So I practice and I have also extensively studied a type of psychotherapy called cognitive behavioral therapy for the treatment of depression and anxiety and Parkinson's disease. And I know that sounds like a mouthful, so I want to try to break it down a little bit so that people can walk away from this presentation with a nice understanding of some things they can start to implement in their lives, you know, from 1 o'clock today onward and to help them cope, you know, as effectively as possible with mood changes and mood swings. So when we say cognitive behavioral therapy, what we're really talking about is really drilling down on our thought process, as well as what we're doing and not doing in response to the challenges that we're facing. So when I work with individuals, I always like to first examine what is the behavioral repertoire of the day. And a lot of times my clients will tease me and they're like, oh, Dr. Dopkin, you're so mean, because I always say, okay, I've got three basic rules of engagement here. If we're going to focus on three things to help to enhance your mood, these are my basic requirements. I think it's incredibly important for people to exercise every day. It doesn't have to be running a marathon or doing anything that is unsafe or overly strenuous, but, you know, a slow walk around the block, yoga, seated exercises, a Parkinson's dance class or a boxing class, whatever you can safely do. Every day, I like to see some type of physical exercise as part of the schedule. Every day, I also like to see some type of social connection with other individuals who you actually like interacting with as part of the daily repertoire as well. And when I say social connection, I don't mean, you know, making plans, you know, to go to the opera or hosting a dinner party for the entire neighborhood. It can be the small changes that we make day in and day out that can be incredibly powerful and incredibly meaningful. So answering the phone when it rings rather than letting it go to voicemail, you know, or responding to your emails and your text messages the day they come in rather than a week later or possibly never. So trying to find small but reasonable ways to connect and to stay in touch with the people that are important to you. And then also setting a goal every day around an area I touched briefly upon earlier, you know, activities that are associated with meaning and reward and pleasure and satisfaction. You know, is there a certain type of music that you like to listen to? And can you set aside 20 minutes a day, you know, to listen to that type of music, or a certain book that you might enjoy reading or listen to in an audiobook format? Can you find pleasure in, you know, mindfully sipping, you know, your morning cup of coffee or tea, you know, outside in your garden each day? You know, so I suggest to people every day from a behavioral perspective, can we have an exercise goal? Can we have a social goal? And can we make sure there's something else we're working towards that's going to enable us to feel good, to find or derive meaning from the day, or to experience a sense of pleasure? Oftentimes, people can also benefit from learning meditation techniques or relaxation skills. So techniques such as deep breathing or visualization or learning different types of muscle relaxation exercises that maybe they can practice ideally, 10 or 15 minutes at a time, twice a day, can be incredibly helpful. So behaviorally, those would be the top, I guess, four things I would recommend regarding mood: exercise, social connection, proactively scheduling your involvement each day in meaningful and pleasurable activities, just like you would schedule your doctor's appointments. And then also maybe experimenting with some breathing, some muscle relaxation, some meditation techniques. So that's the behavioral piece. And then there's the cognitive piece. It's so important for people to be aware, as I mentioned earlier, of that internal dialogue. What are they saying to themselves? How are they interpreting what's happening in their world day in and day out? It may be Parkinson's related or related to some other aspect of their life, but what's the meaning? What's the interpretation? And how can we maybe press pause on some of those really negative things that we may think or say to ourselves, and then maybe examine that thought or that statement a little bit more closely, and then rewind it and replay it in a healthier, more balanced direction. And I want to just quickly share an example of this cognitive reframing that I just described that I hope will really drive the message home. So I share this example with permission from a client of mine, Bill, who I worked with probably 15 years ago at this point. And Bill had later stage Parkinson's when we were working together. He was experiencing, you know, a lot of mood and motor fluctuations, like Dr. Richard had spoke about earlier, as well as a lot of freezing. So Bill came into my office one morning and he was looking very depressed and very demoralized. And we were talking about, you know, what triggered that low mood that he was experiencing. And he said, well, you know, Dr. Dopkin, last night, you know, per usual, you know, I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning and, you know, I went into, you know, the bathroom as I always do every night. And I was washing my hands and about ready, you know, to go back to the bedroom, and I was frozen. I couldn't move my feet. And I recognized in that moment how helpless I was. And so he was labeling himself as helpless for being frozen in the bathroom in the middle of the night. And we spent an hour talking about this and breaking it down. And what Bill revealed to me in the context of that conversation was that he actually took many, many steps to get himself out of that situation, even though he physically could not move his feet. So he was aware that the freezing was a really big problem for him. And this, again, is going back 15 years before we were all, you know, so addicted to our cell phones and our technology, you know, in the way that we are today. But he was forward thinking. He had his cell phone with him. So even though he physically couldn't move his feet, he had his phone and he called his wife on the house phone, woke her up, and asked her to come into the bathroom and to help him back to bed. And when she got up and went into the bathroom, she helped him to practice his PT techniques to break the freeze, and he was able to move. So as we talk through the situation, Bill was able to recognize that even though he was physically unable to move his feet in that situation, he was anything but helpless. So that's an example of the type of reframing that can be critically important and empowering for people to utilize in order to enhance their mood. You know, all of these thoughts constantly are flooding through our minds. We don't have to accept them as the absolute truth just because they are there. It can oftentimes be very important to take a step back and ask ourselves, might there be another way to think about this situation? Am I considering all of the pieces of evidence, all of the facts that are involved in this situation? And if I widen the lens and think about it more deeply, or think about it from an alternative perspective, maybe I can change or revise or reframe my thought. And if I change my thought, maybe that will also help to enhance my mood. So in terms of non-pharmacological approaches, again, just to review, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy really incorporates a lot of these behavior changes and behavior modifications, like I just mentioned, you know, exercise, social connection, meditation, relaxation, pleasant activity scheduling, writing out a daily schedule, having some structure and routine, and really looking more closely at our thoughts and not accepting all of those negative, detrimental thoughts at face value without trying to think about them a little bit more closely and reframe them as possible. And this is a type of non-pharmacological treatment that I've actually studied a fair amount with respect to its impact on mental health in people with Parkinson's disease. To date, I've done three large randomized studies where we've looked at the impact of this type of non-pharmacological treatment compared to just treatment as usual in the Parkinson's community, you know, whatever was being prescribed by the personal healthcare team for the treatment of depression and anxiety. And we look to see how do people who receive cognitive behavioral therapy, how do they do in the short term and in the long run when they receive the CBT plus treatment as usual compared to those who just receive treatment as usual without the skill-based psychotherapeutic approach. And what we found is that when people learn how to make behavior changes, learn how to respond differently to negative mood, learn how to talk back to their negative thoughts, we see really sharp reductions in depression and anxiety, as well as improvements in quality of life and physical functioning. And those effects tend to last even after the therapy stops.
So I think that in Parkinson's, there's, you know, so when people get diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, they're often just told to, you know, take your medication and come back. And I think that it's a very isolating disease for a lot of people. As a physician getting diagnosed with Parkinson's disease at a young age, you know, it became very clear to me pretty quickly that the services that people need for Parkinson's disease haven't really been developed, you know, across the board like they have for cancer patients, where there's a team of people waiting in to take a cancer diagnosis patient right along the way and stay with them. And in Parkinson's, I don't believe that we've developed that yet. But as a physician, I recognized that that was missing. And so as I mentioned earlier in my introduction, I'm a founder of InMotion, which is a wellness center for Parkinson's patients that has, you know, a lot of things under one roof. And not only is there physical activity there, but there's support groups and that are run by licensed social workers. And there's art therapy and music therapy and singing and exercise. And it's amazing how many people, as a physician, you know, I had a lot of people, you know, say, thank you, you helped save my life. But when I walk into InMotion, it's a constant, you know, thank you, because people have been isolated for so long and they've had anxiety and depression that they couldn't get on top of. But just having the social interactions with other people with Parkinson's who understand what they're going through, I think has also been a big help in helping our clients deal with the anxiety and depression.
And it also helps, I might add, to be honest with you, from a, you know, in treating Parkinson's disease, to have a multidisciplinary care team, even if, I mean, under one roof would be fantastic. And even if you can't, though, that utilization of all of those resources, including allied health professionals, like, meaning OT, PT, speech and swallowing, as well as social workers and therapists, like to have all those people communicating with each other, as well as with the primary care doctor, I think is incredibly important, because some things that, you know, if one person does something and another doesn't know, it can impact. And so, for example, you know, I guess just to add that the concept of multidisciplinary care, for all those reasons, I think is really important. And just before I forget, one other thing that I wanted to say, because I know that one of the questions was asked, and which antidepressants don't worsen the Parkinson motor symptoms. And I did want to say that what I've been seeing is that a lot of primary care doctors and psychiatrists are using what we typically call antipsychotics, albeit atypical antipsychotics, for the treatment of anxiety and depression and for help with sleep. And they do help, actually. And these would be medications such as aripiprazole or Abilify, for example, things like that. Now, I have a biased perspective because obviously I see people who come in with Parkinsonian symptoms, but I can tell you that those medications cause Parkinsonism, and they cause Parkinsonism in people who, they cause Parkinsonism in some people who don't have Parkinson's disease. They will likely worsen Parkinsonian motor function in anybody who does have Parkinson's disease. And very interestingly, as our guest, EEO Grammy Wimmer,
Sebastian mentioned
that he developed anxiety and depression prior to the onset. That's not uncommon. And one thing we saw is that patients without any motor symptoms developed depression or anxiety, were given a medication such as Abilify, developed Parkinsonism, and we ended up doing advanced studies like DAT scans. And in some of the cases, actually, these patients did indeed have Parkinson's disease that likely came out earlier than it might have, being precipitated by these medications. Some people ended up not having Parkinson's disease, but had what we would call drug-induced Parkinsonism caused by these medications. So I do think it's very important, because I do see this a lot, where patients were being treated for anxiety and depression with what we call, quote, atypical antipsychotics, not for psychosis, and it definitely worsens Parkinson's. So just to put that out there.
Sebastian, did you have any problems trying to find a medication that was effective for your anxiety and depression? Have you had to bounce around from medications or?
Yeah, no, I did, because I'm, you know, I work in music, and when I first, before I knew I had Parkinson's, I started taking medication, and it really, it made me just feel nothing. And that's very bad for, you know, if you're trying to make music, if you're just, you know, I felt fine, but everything was fine. And it just creatively, it kind of stunted me. So I went off the medication, and what I found that worked for me was actually the Mirapex. You know, it didn't actually work for me with the motor part of it, but it worked for me as far as the depression goes and the anxiety. So that's what I've been taking, because it's a fine line for me to be able to do my job. I kind of have to be able to really access emotionally, be emotionally available for the work that I do. And not have anything muted. And the Mirapex was the one thing that I found kind of did that for me. So yeah, it wasn't right away that I was able to find something that worked.
And I think it's, as a physician, we know that not all medication is going to work for every person. So there has to be some patience in terms of waiting to see whether something is going to have an effect or not. But if it's not working, then it's probably time to talk to your physician and see whether they can make an improvement on what that drug regimen is. I'm going to move to the last slide
definitely.
Here, which is talking about research. And I'd like maybe Dr. Dopkin can start by talking some about some of the research that she's done, I think, in terms of using technology to deliver care, especially in this day and age when people can't leave their houses very easily. What are we doing to improve on Parkinson's care in that genre?
Really important topic. And, you know, I mentioned a few moments ago that I've done three randomized control studies looking at the effects of cognitive behavioral therapy for the treatment of depression in Parkinson's disease. The first of those studies was, you know, traditional brick and mortar come into the clinic in order to participate in this research program. The last two studies that were recently completed in the past year involved administering the cognitive behavioral therapy on a telemedicine platform. So in one of the studies that was generously funded by the Fox Foundation, we administered the CBT treatment by telephone directly into people's homes. And in the second study, we administered the treatment via web-based video conferencing. So both studies use the telemedicine platform to bring treatment directly to people's homes to really bypass access barriers to care. And in both of those studies, I think the really exciting and promising result is that not only was the treatment helpful administered remotely, but the magnitude of improvement was identical, like almost down to the 100th decimal point place in terms of the benefit that we saw with respect to reduction in depression and anxiety. So nothing was lost in terms of effectiveness when we administered the psychotherapy via phone or via web-based live video conferencing, but so much was gained because we could cast a much wider net, and we could offer treatment to individuals who otherwise would have been unable to access it if they had to travel to a clinic on a weekly basis and sit face-to-face in the same room with a counselor. And I think telemedicine is being used.
Trained.
Yes.
I just want to interrupt that very few people are trained as well as Dr. Dopkin. In the cognitive behavioral therapy for Parkinson's, it's pretty specific. And so, you know, that, you know, it's important and a very specific kind of, you know, rather than supportive therapy. So just to add that.
Yes, exactly. No, it's very structured. It's very skills based. And of course, we are supportive and we listen and we help people process their thoughts and feelings in addition to working on coping skills to address them. So I don't want to make it sound like, you know, people are signing up to take a class. You know, it is a very interpersonal exchange. But that being said, I think in order to be effective in one's role as a counselor with individuals with Parkinson's, it's so important to be knowledgeable about Parkinson's and about the symptoms and the medications used to treat it and, you know, the on-off fluctuations that may be physical or cognitive or emotional or all three. And I think telemedicine also offers promise, not just in terms of making specialized treatments more accessible, but it can also allow a pool of highly specialized providers to reach the masses who otherwise might not be able to receive services. So, you know, I think recent research has shown that telemedicine is not second best. It's just as good, and then sometimes it might be better for the Parkinson's community to receive services via telemedicine because it will allow them to access specialists and specialized care that they otherwise would not be able to be connected with.
Well, look at this. It looks like our time is up. I want to thank you again for being a part of our community and for joining us today. And thanks to our panelists for sharing your time and expertise on this very important topic. For those of you who do experience mood changes, this serves as an important reminder that in spite of what Parkinson's deals us, there is plenty that we can do to positively impact our overall quality of life. We'll be sending a link to the webinar on demand to listen again or share as you'd like. We hope you found it helpful. Please mark your calendar for our next webinar, July 16th. And in the meantime, stay home, stay safe, and stay connected. This is Dr. Karen Jaffe signing off.
Thanks for listening. Community members like you are bringing us closer than ever to a world without Parkinson's disease. Learn how you can support the Michael J. Fox Foundation in its mission at michaeljfox.org.
This is Michael J. Fox. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation's work and how you can help speed a cure at michaeljfox.org.